This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the National Institute of Health has officially kicked off its much-anticipated All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative. It's an ambitious project that seeks to advance medicine by enlisting the participation of 1 million citizen scientists from all walks of life willing to offer up their medical and genomic data to advance the knowledge and understanding of health and disease in a way that has never been possible before.
Well, this is a program that we are very proud to be part of here at our organization, Mark. At the official kickoff this past weekend, NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins sure didn't hold back his enthusiasm. He called the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative one of the most ambitious research projects ever conducted in the United States. And that's from the guy who oversaw the team that mapped the human genome, a towering achievement. So very exciting.
It really is. And he's absolutely right. It's ambitious, it's groundbreaking, and quite vast in scope. They're seeking 1 million volunteer citizen scientists to offer up their genomic, biological, medical, and behavioral information, all to be coalesced in a massive database to allow researchers to get a more complete understanding of how disease happens and, more importantly, find ways to prevent it from happening in the first place. We've talked a lot on this show about the promise of precision medicine. This is the first real step in that direction.
They say that knowledge is power, Mark, and this Precision Medicine Initiative is going to provide so much vital information on so many aspects of population health. It's going to create a much more complete body of knowledge about health and disease pathology across a diverse population of Americans. And as we know, health and disease are greatly impacted by people's racial and ethnic background, their economic status, their geography, their culture, as well as their genes. So this is incredibly exciting to be on the ground floor of this endeavor, and I think we're all just very excited about where it's going to take us.
No, you're absolutely right. And speaking of exciting new frontiers in science and human biology, that leads us to our guest today, Margaret. The mapping of the human genome a decade ago opened up the door to all kinds of new discoveries. And there's a similar project just getting underway that could have huge implications for understanding the fundamental human biology more completely. Our guest co-chairs of the Human Cell Atlas, which seeks to map every cell in the human body, something that really wasn't even possible without recent technological breakthroughs and advances.
Dr. Aviv Regev and Dr. Sarah Teichman will join us to talk about this massive project currently underway, which not only seeks to identify every cell, but to map its mechanisms, its interactions with other cells, and its lifespan. With trillions of cells in the human body, this is going to take some time, but the implications for broadening our understanding of human biology and health are just astounding. We are really living in amazing times, and we look forward to hearing more about the creation of the Human Cell Atlas.
Lori Robertson also stops by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio, or you can also find us on iTunes.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Sarah Teichman and Aviv Regev of the Human Cell Atlas Project in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Walmart weighing in on the opioid crisis, announcing it's cracking down on initial opioid prescriptions within the next 60 days, saying they will limit prescriptions to just a 7-day supply. Walmart also providing customers with a special pouch designed to dispose of unused opioids. The CDC estimates 115 people die per day from some kind of opioid overdose. Calorie counts coming to a food counter near you. The law requiring calorie counts on a number of restaurant food products is now officially in effect. It was part of the original Affordable Care Act in 2010, but was repeatedly blocked by lobbyists in the food industry claiming it was a hardship. But the pared-down version is now official. It applies to chain restaurants, convenience stores, movie theaters, and sit-down establishments. Some evidence suggests posting calorie counts of foods leads consumers to pause before making unhealthy choices. Kids should not be consuming any nicotine products. That's the word from FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on this week's announced crackdown on vaping products being marketed specifically to kids with flavors like gummy bears. Early evidence suggests while teens are smoking fewer combustible cigarettes, there's been an increase in vaping, significant increase, which can lead kids to becoming addicted to nicotine. Gottlieb says they will be stepping up enforcement of these stricter guidelines. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sarah Teichman, head of cellular genetics at the Wellcome Sanger Institute at Cambridge, a nonprofit British Genomics Research Institute, and Dr. Raviv Regev, chair of the faculty and co-director of the Cells Circuit Program at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Both are co-chairs of the Human Cell Atlas Organizing Committee, a global collaborative of leading scientists dedicated to creating the first complete mapping of all human cells. Dr. Regev was awarded the NIH Director's Pioneer Award and the Overton Prize, having earned her PhD in computational biology at the University of Tel Aviv. And Dr. Teichman has earned numerous awards as well, including the Lister Prize and the Colworth Medal. She earned her bachelor's in biochemistry from Trinity College, Cambridge University, and her PhD in molecular biology at Cambridge. Sarah and Aviv, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
So much. Aviv, let's start with you. We're beginning to gain an exponential understanding of human biology through the Human Genome Project, a collective and global research initiative that ultimately led to the sequencing of the human genome. Often with such dramatic achievements, these discoveries can unleash a whole set of new questions and answers. And you're at the helm of an equally ambitious effort, the Human Cell Atlas Project, which the Genome Project provided some of the impetus for. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about the goals and the mission of your endeavor and highlight some of the challenges and opportunities of this undertaking.
Absolutely. And it's wonderful that you started with the Human Genome Project, because just like the Human Genome Project was a project to find the genes, which are one part of the periodic table of elements of the human body, the Human Cell Atlas aims to find all the cells, which are another set of elements of the human body, except that there are 37.2 trillion of them. And so just that sheer number, together with the huge size of the human body, I think really underscores how difficult this can be. The other thing that's difficult is that our cells are different. Different types of cells look different from each other, and they express different genes in them, and they have different molecules inside them. And until recently, we could only really analyze multiple cells at once, maybe millions or tens of millions of them together. We used to liken this to a fruit smoothie. We would take all of them together, grind them up, and then look at the average. But the average doesn't really tell you about the individual cells, and if you don't know which cells are there, you end up with something that can be very confusing. Now we have new techniques that allow us to look at individual cells, either after we separate them one from the other, that's called single-cell genomics, or when the cells are in the tissue, but looking at all of their molecules at once. And with these new methods, you can think of it as new microscopes that allow us to look at cells, we can really take on this challenge of the trillions of cells that are different from each other and are organized throughout the body. And with this, we hope that we can build a real comprehensive reference map or periodic table of the elements of the cells that make up the human body. We definitely hope that, like all reference maps, when you have a better map, you understand better what you look at and you can navigate it better, that we can find both the cells that are there in health, but also to use this information in order to better diagnose and monitor and treat human disease.
I want to ask Sarah, you've both said that this project is going to lead to some very exciting discoveries down the line, but that first, to get there, you have to create a new kind of research infrastructure. And you've assembled an international team of computational scientists and microbiologists and the whole panoply of experts from so many scientific disciplines just to create a framework that can support this kind of effort. Help our listeners understand the complexities that are involved in scaling up the Human Cell Atlas Project and how your team is navigating some of these foundational logistics in order to actually bring this project to scale.
Sure. So I'm sitting over here in Cambridge, UK, in the original Cambridge. And the complexities, you're absolutely right. It is complex. It involves lots of different disciplines. And as you can imagine, where that complexity starts is with acquiring samples of human tissues. And that really starts with our friends, the medical doctors, the surgeons, also the biomedical specialists that focus on different tissues and that give biopsies. We also have very close collaborations with the transplant surgeons for projects that can access samples that are not required for transplantation. And those samples are then analyzed using a variety of cutting-edge genomics technologies, and single-cell genomics is one of them. And the excitement there is really the resolution revolution that's taken place in genomics, where we can now study DNA and RNA nucleic acids in individual cells. And so that's an incredibly exciting. And that resolution revolution is also going to the spatial level, where we can study cells in their spatial context and the expression of genes, the molecular fingerprint, in terms of resolving individual cells, but also their neighborhood. And then the output from that data generation, of course, has to be processed. So the technologies are genome biologists, I would say technology developers. And the data processing is then carried out in a data coordination platform that we're happy to elaborate on later. And that's a lot of software developers, programming, really people who specialize in databases, management of large data flows, and organization of humongous data sets. And then the final sort of level, the fourth level, is the analysis of that data and the interpretation and biological understanding through data mining and analysis. And that's where computational biologists come in, machine learning experts, biologists who interact with the computational specialists. It's a collaborative effort. And it's really those four levels that have really catalyzed the whole Human Cell Atlas Consortium and propelled it forwards. And so those are very different types of people that are involved from all over the world, and that makes it a huge amount of fun. It's a global effort that's very interdisciplinary.
Thank you, sir. That sounds so exciting. I don't know if there's an IRBs. And as I understand it, you're not only seeking to identify potential billions of cells in the human body, the taxonomy alone seems daunting, but also to categorize each cell and how it fits in and how they behave, lifespan, their molecular mechanism, and other things. So each and every identified cell will also become a subset of identifying properties. And you envision there'll be terabytes, maybe zettabytes, or maybe, as Sarah said, humongous amount of data that will be needed here. My God, there's so much going on here. And also, it's going to be adaptable and accessible to many scientists and researchers. We've been working with NIH and Dr. Collins on this All of Us initiative, and sort of the curating of how scientists access the data will be very important. So maybe opine on some of those.
So you're right. This is going to be a lot of data. I already said 37.2 trillion cells in the human body, and even if just some of them make it to the Human Cell Atlas, that's still going to be as big data as any of the big data endeavors that we're familiar with. That's actually been front and center in our minds from the first day we started thinking about the Human Cell Atlas. And so one of the first activities to get going before the data was being collected even was our data coordination platform, which is really a partnership across multiple institutions, including the EBI in the UK, UCSC in Santa Cruz, the Broad Institute where I am, and also engineers from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, who are building together a data coordination platform to house all of this data and make it, first of all, openly accessible to all. You mentioned IRBs. Everything is with appropriate consents, but the data will be open and accessible to all, and the data platform itself is also open source, which means that anyone can use the same
That's
code
great.
For many other applications. It's funny that you mention All of Us. In fact, some of the team of engineers that participates in building All of Us also participates in building the data coordination platform, and so there's also a connection to this more clinical view of the world. There has been such an explosion of abilities today in the world of software engineering and machine learning that has happened really in parallel to the explosion of our ability to collect these kinds of data. And so as a result, we can bring to bear all of this wonderful engineering and machine learning skill on this kind of problem so that the data can not only be housed and processed at the scale at which it's collected, which will be millions and billions of cells, but also it can be served with the right kind of visualization and query tools so that biologists and medical experts can actually use it.
Well, the pace of acceleration of knowledge is really breathtaking. And yet there's always some of those fundamental things we have to come back to. And one of them, Sarah, is governance. So let's talk about governance for a moment of the Human Cell Atlas. And Mark and I know from our conversations with Dr. Francis Collins of the National Institute of Health, who led the team that mapped the human genome, that the goal there was clearly, as it sounds like with you, to open this information up to scientific researchers to further accelerate this pace of discovery. For you, there's four pillars that you've identified on which this project is based. Share with us what those pillars are and some of the standards that the Human Cell Atlas will operate by.
Sure. So in terms of a basic pillar, and this is something we share in common with the Human Genome Project, is we want this data to be openly accessible for the scientific community, the medical community, and everyone who has an interest in human cells and tissues, tissue architecture and genomic data. We're also guided very much by a collaborative interdisciplinary spirit. You know, this is such a big vision and ambition that we realize that we have to work together internationally to achieve this. So coordination with each other is something that we're striving towards, and we have been from the very beginning. You can see on the humancellus.org webpage that we have an organizing committee, and Aviv and I co-chair that, a core of just over 20 people who are in that committee and responsible for the overarching organization. There are working groups that are responsible for the data coordination platform, the metadata. And then really this links also to the way we work, and that is that we have the data coordination platform, but also an analysis garden, an analysis working group where there's a rich ecosystem of computational methods and algorithms that are developed by the analysis working group and indeed any interested group that can then share their methods, and these methods can be shared across the community. On the biological side, the way we're organized is that we have collaborative biological networks that focus on specific systems and organs. So, you know, there's one for lung, kidney, cardiovascular system, and brain, and so on and so forth. And these bring together scientific experts from the community who want to work together and share their expertise and their progress and coordinate to map these particular tissues and organs and systems of cells and so on. And then also we really emphasize that we want to catalyze technology development. And the Human Cell Atlas, I think, has played a role in this very rapid resolution revolution, I would say, in genomics, where single-cell genomics technologies have just become extremely scalable and robust and affordable. So single cells can now be sequenced. And the same sort of revolution, I think, is starting to happen in spatial methods, that we can actually measure molecules in their spatial context, in the tissue, within their tissue context.
We're speaking today with Dr. Sarah Teichman, head of cellular genetics at the Wellcome Sanger Institute at Cambridge, a nonprofit British genomic research institute, and Dr. Aviv Regev, chair of the faculty and co-director of the Cell Circuit Program at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, co-chairs of the Human Cell Atlas Organizing Committee, a global collaborative of leading scientists dedicated to creating the first mapping of all human cells. Aviv, I'm really struck by the fundamental idea here that we've been looking at cells with 150-year-old technology. Mapping of the genome has unlocked many of those doors, and now we have the dramatic potential for CRISPR technology. And I know the Broad Institute has been front and center in that with CRISPR-9, and big analytics are accelerating our ability to collect, interpret data. I want to even share with our listeners about these recent technological developments, how they're making this ambitious project possible.
So I'll start with the profiling approaches, the approaches to measure the individual molecules. You should think about it as though you're trying to build a map, like a Google map. We like to say Google Maps for the human body. And a map has to have coordinates. The coordinates in our case are going to be the expression level of every individual gene. And the really transformational step that has happened is that we can measure the expression level of every individual gene. So to know where the cell is positioned on each of these coordinates for every individual cell at a very massive scale. At first we could do one cell and then a handful of cells, and now it can be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions are completely within reach in a single experiment. And similarly to that, as Sarah described, we can do it for cells when they're separated from each other, and we can do it for the cells when we see not only their coordinates in terms of the expression level of each genome, but we can see also their real physical coordinates. We can see where they are in three dimensions in a piece of tissue. That's like getting a new pair of eyeglasses, right? If you're nearsighted and you don't have your glasses on, the world is very, very blurry. When you get your glasses and you put them on, all of a sudden everything comes into sharp relief. That's how cells got discovered in the first place due to a new technology, the microscope. And that's how we get to rediscover them in their full richness using these new approaches. But once we discover that we have the cells, we have one element in the periodic table and another element in the periodic table, the immediate next question that we want to ask, what controls them? What makes them in their special way? And this is where the ability to genetically manipulate cells becomes so useful. And that's what CRISPR allows us to do. Not inside humans, but outside people, in organoids, in cell culture, in model organisms. You can now start manipulating the different genes that are highlighted by this reference map. And the map, together with algorithms, might predict this specific gene is critical to making this cell. What would happen if I take this gene out is a question that becomes very easy to answer with the help of CRISPR. So these two were really made for each other. And in fact, there are now methods by which we can take a large number of cells, use CRISPR to remove one or more gene from every cell, and then use these single-cell approaches to really measure what was the effect of CRISPR in each cell.
Very exciting. And as you both are certainly making the case, complex scientific research requires a lot of intellect and determination, but it also requires resources. And I know the Human Cell Atlas is getting help from a number of sectors, including the teams at the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard, as well as your research facility, the Wellcome Sanger Institute at Cambridge. I also understand there's some significant philanthropic input from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which has a mission of ending preventable disease by the end of this century. Talk with us about the major partners in the Human Cell Atlas and how their support is really essential to supporting this undertaking.
Sure. The Human Cell relies on the support of many funders, and that encompasses both government funders, many private foundations, and large institutional ones, smaller ones. And that's what's really enabled us to hold the community together, start the data coordination platform, start producing the data that will go into the Atlas, provide some infrastructure for the consortium. So from the early days, the Wellcome Foundation, also the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, the Kavli Foundation, and now more recently, the NIH HubMap. So the National Institutes of Health have a sort of sister project that's called the Human Biomolecular Mapping Project, and the NIH Cancer Moonshot. It's worth mentioning that the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative has provided support very specifically for the data coordination platform, and that's where the data that's created by the HCA projects will be stored and served and organized. They're also supporting pilot projects on technology development and one-year pilot projects on computational tool development that will all hopefully help the Human Cell Atlas effort.
Well, that's wonderful. And Aviv, you've identified more than a million cells so far. There's obviously a long way to go. And your website suggests that when this project's completed, it's going to have a dramatic impact, give us a better understanding on the immune system, the brain, cancer, developmental cells, just to name a few. And as you look ahead, what excites you most about the potential of the Human Cell Atlas to yield new insights into some of the biological mysteries we still face? And what are the greatest potential for discovery and biomedical advancement that you think might come out of this?
You can think of it sort of as augmented reality of our body, right? And so that has impacts for both the most fundamental questions in biology: what are the cell types that are there, how do they arise in development, and how do they behave in physiology? And we're already getting answers like these. We discover new cell types in the blood, new cell types in the lung that we didn't even know exist. We find where they come from. And then we can ask questions on how do they behave when things are good in homeostasis and physiology, and also how things go awry. I think in the context of disease, it can make it quite clear why this would be so dramatic. Some of the most basic tests that are done when we're sick are basically single-cell assays, the blood draw. You count how many cells are there of maybe six different types, except that we know that there should be dozens of types and they can be in different types of physiological states. So you can imagine a complete blood count 2.0 that does it at that level of resolution and tells us much more about the status of our body right now. Same is true when a biopsy is taken and you take a slide and you do a pathology section. You stain it really with those 100-year-old or more techniques to look at tissue sections, except that you will now look at all of the molecules that are there and you will understand how the cells relate to each other and maybe find new avenues for therapeutic interventions. When we find genes from genetic studies that are associated with disease, we don't know where these genes act. But the Human Cell Atlas would give us a reference map to really say, this gene is actually important in that kind of cell. That's the next place to look at, both to understand disease mechanism and to try and develop the new drugs. When we screen for drugs, we could screen them for giving the cells a particular set of molecules that is desirable. And when we treat patients, we would be able to monitor them with this augmented reality. And we could, for example, monitor much better for toxicity because we would know all of the other cells that might be impacted by the same drugs. Both for fundamental biology and for biomedical research and applications, we think that having a map is much better than having no map at all. But I think we will leave it at that.
Well, we've been speaking today with Dr. Sarah Teichman, head of cellular genetics at the Wellcome Sanger Institute at Cambridge, and Dr. Aviv Regev, chair of the faculty and co-director of the Cells Circuit Program at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Co-chairs of the Human Cell Atlas Organizing Committee, they are dedicated to creating the first complete mapping of human cells. You can learn more about their work by going to humancellatlas.org or follow their work on Twitter at Human Cell Atlas or the Broad Institute at Broad Institute and the Wellcome Sanger Institute at Sanger Institute. Sarah, Aviv, thank you so much for sharing your very exciting and groundbreaking work with us and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Do 20% of the children in the United States go to bed hungry? That's what House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said, but we found she misrepresented government data. Pelosi claimed that, quote, 1 in 5 children in America goes to sleep hungry at night. There is no precise measurement for childhood hunger in the United States. But the Census Bureau's most recent household food security survey found that about 6.5 million children, or 8.8%, quote, lived in households in which one or more child was food insecure. Pelosi's office referred us to a U.S. Department of Agriculture 2017 report on food security. The USDA administers the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, once known as food stamps, and several child nutrition programs for low-income families in an attempt to combat hunger. The USDA's report is based on the 2016 Current Population Survey Food Security Supplement, an annual survey conducted by the Census Bureau. And as Pelosi's office told us, the report says 16.5% of U.S. households with children were food insecure at some point during 2016. But that doesn't mean that the children in those households go to bed hungry. The government differentiates food insecurity by whether it affected adults only or also children. For children, 8.8% lived in households where at least one child was food insecure. Until 2006, low food security was known as food insecurity without hunger, and very low food security was called food insecurity with hunger. And in 0.8% of households with children, both children and adults had very low food security. The USDA said that food insecurity was severe enough in those households that children were hungry or skipped meals. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.